It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. Where were you when you heard the news this week?
I think I was at home with my wife because it was between Christmas and New Year's.
In a major escalation in tensions between the U.S. and Iran, the top Iranian general has been killed in an airstrike while leaving the Baghdad airport.
You think you have a lot of questions about what happened this week? Foreign policy expert Scott Anderson worked at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. He was just as shocked as the rest of us, and he had even more questions.
I had just written another article on the December 29th airstrikes against Kataib Hezbollah sites in Iraq, then heard about this action.
Qasem Soleimani was one of the most powerful figures in the Middle East. This attack comes after Iranian-backed groups breached the U.S. embassy in Baghdad just 2 days ago.
Initially, I had, frankly, some difficulty believing that it was 100% true and that it was 100% a U.S. action. My first thoughts were, what will this mean for the U.S.-Iraq relationship moving forward?
The parliament has just passed a resolution to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country.
I was just kind of surprised that it would be undertaken, particularly so soon after the December 29th strikes had triggered a strong reaction among Iraqis. It's not going to be the same. This was going to be a moment where that relationship was likely to change dramatically, if not come to an end.
President Trump has said he will impose harsh sanctions on Iraq if the government there tries to make U.S. forces leave the country.
I'm a lawyer by training, and so I tend to think of things in terms of legal authority.
We will respond with great force and great vigor if the Iranian leadership makes a bad decision. Every action we take will be consistent with the international rule of law.
What was the president's basis for taking this step?
Qasem Soleimani has been killed.
What policy justification would there be for the president to take this action?
And his bloody rampage is now forever gone.
Even if he were authorized to do so as a legal matter.
We got him.
Which often is a much harder question to answer.
One of the big questions I had, and a lot of people had right away, was this legal? Can an American president legally assassinate a top leader in another country?
It is a tricky question.
And that right there tells you a whole lot about the murky world of law and foreign policy. I mean, you would think there would be pretty clear rules about who a president can and can't kill. But Scott Anderson, a Mideast expert and former legal advisor to the State Department in Baghdad, says they're more like guidelines. Scott, when I heard that the U.S. had deliberately killed Iran's top military leader, I kept thinking, back in the 70s and 80s, this would have been unheard of. Didn't Gerald Ford adopt a presidential ban on assassinations?
He did, yeah, after the Church Committee hearings regarding reforms in the intelligence community. And that ban is still in the books. It's currently part of Executive Order 12333, I believe, which was adopted by President Reagan but has been kind of kept in place subsequently and just amended and tweaked.
Wait, if the ban is still in place, doesn't that specifically prohibit the action President Trump just took?
Well, again, the question comes down to how you interpret what assassination means. In this case, the term assassination isn't defined in the executive order.
Doesn't it just mean killing somebody?
No, because presumably there are less specific terms that would mean killing someone, like killing someone, right? Assassination seems to imply a more technical context or meaning.
Okay, legally, what is an assassination?
Exactly. Well, we don't know exactly for the reason that a lot of the executive branch's interpretations of how that ban has been applied and implemented are not publicly available. What we do understand from media reporting and from snippets of at least one OLC opinion from the Obama era, that is the Awolaki OLC opinion, we understand that acts that are seen as lawful acts of self-defense under international law, presumably where the president is acting to defend the country, those do not constitute assassinations because they are lawful acts. Unlawful acts, unlawful murders, if it were to kill a foreign leader who in no way presented a threat, for example, those would pose a harder question, at least, under the assassination test, although we, again, don't know exactly what the full scope of how it's been interpreted is.
Wait, are you telling me there is a legal definition of assassination, but it's private? It's secret?
There is a set of precedents and views adopted by the executive branch probably around that prohibition. At least we've been led to believe that there are, and they're not publicly available. It probably doesn't boil down to something like a concrete definition, but it's a set of precedents about how that standard has been applied.
How can that be legal that the public can't know? How can you have a president say, I can do something legally, but I'm not going to tell you why, and you can't know why it's legal?
In the assassination ban zone specifically, that is not a law. That's a presidential policy through an executive order. And so really, in any context, the president can come in and say, I'm changing this policy, I'm tweaking it, I'm adjusting it, I'm adopting contrary guidance. And so that one, they have particular leeway interpreting and applying. But there are certain steps Congress and other institutions can take to make that information more publicly available.
Right. So during the Obama administration, of course, there were dozens of these drone strikes on individuals. I guess I'm wondering, is there a legal difference between killing the top general in Iran and killing an ISIS terrorist in Syria?
That's a good question. I think a lot of it boils down to these ideas of imminence, the ideas of whether it's a necessary and proportional action to address a threat against the United States and where that threat comes from. It's supposed to be a little bit more constrained. The idea is to not create a cycle of escalation, instead to act in a way that's, again, proportional and necessary in relation to the threat against you. And that is what's drawn in question here in substantial part by the Soleimani strike. Is this necessary and proportional? Is this something that we can justify on this usual scale, as opposed to other scales, to much larger scale armed conflict that even the United States doesn't maintain that we're in with Iran at this point? And that's part of the reason, again, it's proven so controversial.
So you've described a situation in which recent presidents, Bush, Obama, and now Trump, have increasingly pushed the envelope on the executive branch's legal authority to use military force. At this point, reading between the lines, it kind of seems like the executive branch doesn't actually have much of a check on its ability to start a war.
I would not go quite that far.
How far would you go?
I think the president has really broad discretion in interpreting his own constitutional and statutory authority to use military force. And until Congress steps in and starts imposing clear limits, and or the federal courts step up and start being more willing to take on these legal questions, that's likely to remain the case.
Is there a legal definition of when a war starts, or even a legal definition of war?
There are definitions of all those concepts in different contexts. So honestly, the idea of just thinking about war as a binary state doesn't work, certainly in the post-9/11 era, and really hasn't worked, I think, through a good part of the 20th century, because the way we think about national security threats, whereas they were once very much condensed to concrete threats that can be addressed through a state of war against another country, now they're much more disaggregated and they're much more sustained. And the approach has been to kind of begin mingling peacetime and wartime together by providing more diversified bundles of legal authorities.
Wow. That's just kind of a dark vision of the future in which peacetime and wartime are just all mingled up together.
Personally, I think I would be much more uncomfortable with the idea that wherever we face these national security threats, we either have to go all in or not through a fully declared state of war. I'm okay with the idea that we can strike more complicated approaches and complicated policy responses without that strict binary. But it does rely upon careful consideration, a Congress that was willing to think ahead, and frankly, a president who's responsible enough to exercise the authorities given to him in a wise manner. And where you lack those things, it can be a dangerous circumstance.
Scott Anderson is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former legal advisor to the U.S. Embassy in Iraq. To launch or not to launch a strike. We've seen what it looks like in the movies. A lot of people in heavily decorated uniforms in the Situation Room, making life or death decisions. Samantha Power has been there. She was Barack Obama's ambassador to the UN, and she's critical of President Trump's decision to kill General Soleimani. But she had her own challenges. When Steve Paulson talked with her recently, he asked about the two most difficult foreign policy issues she faced, Libya and Syria. Maybe you remember, Libya blew up first. Rebel groups rose up to oppose the regime of Muammar Gaddafi, who in turn vowed to crush them.
When the issue came to President Obama in the Situation Room in March of 2011, it came at a time when Gaddafi seemed on the verge of taking over towns that had very early on declared loyalty to the opposition. I think a lot of people understandably disagree with the decision that President Obama made that I supported wholeheartedly at the time. But what I tried to do in the book—
The decision being airstrikes.
The decision being to lead a coalition to prevent Gaddafi from taking over these opposition-held towns to seek to avert a massacre. And again, I supported Obama's decision wholeheartedly at the time. But the reason that seemed like the right tool to employ, notwithstanding my and, Lord knows, President Obama's great skepticism about the use of military force, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa, was that what was coming before us was a leader who had said he was going to hunt down anybody who was loyal to the opposition, house by house, exterminate them like rats. He had a history of rounding people up and staging mass executions, including of his political opponents. And there was no sign that, given that history, that the opposition was going to just vacate the premises or surrender. But the other thing we had that nobody remembers is that the entire Arab League, which is very skeptical about the use of American power, was calling on the United States to ensure that the UN Security Council, quote unquote, met its responsibilities to protect civilians. And we'd put in place super stringent economic sanctions. So we'd sort of played every tool in the toolbox, and yet Gaddafi was on the gates of Benghazi and four other civilian inhabited towns. The world was clamoring for the next step. President Obama took the initiative and decided to go to the Security Council and see if we could get authorization, legal authorization to protect civilians, and he got it. And that's the first time that kind of authorization had been forthcoming in almost two decades. I mention it to just take note of the counterfactual, which is, had President Obama not gone to the Security Council, I don't think there's much likelihood that Libya could have been brought back to its sort of stable precursor. I think it would more likely today would look kind of like Syria.
Let's talk about today for a moment with Libya, because so these efforts removed Gaddafi from power. And obviously, he was then later captured and killed. Today, most people look at Libya as a nightmare. A failed state, anarchy, chaos everywhere. Do you have any regrets, sort of looking back on what happened there?
The Security Council resolution that we were fulfilling, with, again, the backing of the world, was a civilian protection resolution.
It wasn't necessarily to remove him from power.
It was not to remove him from power. I mean, Barack Obama, again, very openly, I'm not in the regime change business. It doesn't end well, precisely because of the kind of vacuum that gets created. But then over those weeks, we have this challenge, right, which is Gaddafi keeps targeting civilians. Gaddafi does not accept any of the African Union, the American, the European efforts to have some kind of diplomatic discussions about how to end this peacefully. And so it goes on and on and on. But at a certain point, the mission absolutely did bleed into, not that NATO was targeting Gaddafi, that never happened, but that fundamentally, this was going on, and the rebels on the ground were targeting Gaddafi. What President Obama says is that he says, look, I still think going into Libya was the right thing to do, given what we knew at the time.
But he's also said it was the worst mistake of his presidency, not planning for the aftermath.
The not planning, is he has said that. But the challenge with that, and he and I have gone back and forth on this, is we have plans out the wazoo. I mean, somebody will use FOIA and see all of our aftermath plans. But the Libyans said no. you know, we've been under Gaddafi for all these years. We're ready to build our own country. And they had free elections, relatively free elections. But fundamentally, the security vacuum, the tribal fiefdoms, and the fact that Gaddafi had gutted rule of law and any kind of stable institutions in the country over such a long period of time meant that that quickly devolved into chaos, but not nowhere near as bad as the chaos we now see today, which is downright civil war.
So let's contrast that with what happened in Syria. We're in the middle of the Syrian civil war. Assad has used chemical weapons to gas the people fighting him, the rebels. 1,400 people were killed. Obama famously had said this is his red line. Using chemical weapons was not acceptable. I think the widespread assumption was there would be American airstrikes against Assad at that time. Obama didn't do that. And you pushed for that, right, that action? But he said,
I didn't have to. I mean, we didn't even have a debate of the kind that you see in Hollywood movies. This was all Obama. I mean, this was not—
He didn't really consult with you?
I mean, when he saw that 1,400 people had been gassed, he made his mind up. He was going to take military action against Syrian military installations, no question. And what happened, as I describe in the book in very personal terms, because I'm there, I'm 3 weeks into my job, I'm nursing my one-year-old daughter at the same time, I'm trying to figure out basically how to even get to the UN Security Council because I had just arrived. And President Obama decides to use force, and it's my job to assemble an international coalition in support. And at the same time, there are UN weapons inspectors on the ground in Syria. David Cameron had gone to the British Parliament. They had rejected his desire to be part of this coalition, so our coalition was down to the United States and France. And at that point, the president, again, didn't decide not to use force, as is commonly understood. He decided, I'm going to get Congress on board. People now, years later, say, oh, that was just Obama. He knew Congress would never. I mean, shouldn't he have known? He must have known. How could you not know? It was the Republicans. They were opposed to everything he did. Those are such reasonable questions. And I am here to tell you, he thought he was going to get congressional support. And any revisionism to the contrary, he thought he was going to get congressional support. Hmm. Israel was completely behind this initiative. It was going to be very limited. It was so narrow from his standpoint.
So I want to ask a counterfactual question here. What if? What if the U.S. had taken more forceful action, military action? What would be different now? Because obviously what happened then was Russia and Iran moved in and helped prop up Assad, and he's still very much in power today. Could you imagine a scenario where—
I can imagine.
We'd have a better Syria now?
I spend a lot of time imagining better scenarios because it's hard to think of a worse scenario. I mean, 500,000 people have been killed. Half the population has been displaced, millions into neighboring countries. That refugee flow then gave rise, of course, to the further refugee flow across Europe, which in turn, I think, played a very pivotal role in the Brexit decision by British voters. So had he gone forward, I think a couple things. One, the chemical weapons genie would on one level been put back in the bottle, not indefinitely. Airstrikes would have deterred him, I think, up to a point, but Assad's MO in this war was test, test, test.
Right.
And I think part of what the red line sequence did is it exposed for Putin and for Assad how divided America is at the moment, how exhausted we are to this day now, 18 years in Afghanistan and all the years in Iraq. But I think to look back, the way the counterfactual would go is you would deter his use of that weapon. You would use that then to energize a diplomatic process in which Assad was feeling great impunity. I think with John Kerry as the Secretary of State and his indefatigability, with me and other diplomats right there behind him, relentless in wanting to pursue peace for Syria, that it could have just—
It could have led to some sort of a diplomatic—
It would have at least turbocharged—
Maybe not solution, but at least—
Mitigation. Yeah. And we never— None of our mitigation plans really succeeded. Yeah. I write in the book, one of the themes of my book is when you're failing big, find something you can do that is useful.
I want to pull back because it seems to me there's a much bigger question, especially for American liberals and progressives. That's the use of military force, U.S. military force. Of course, the critique that you get from progressives is that in the end, it always becomes a tool of American imperialism. there's sort of this intention to do good, to prevent suffering. But, you know, in the end, it advances American interests. And it's once again the United States playing global policeman. And maybe it's time to stop doing that.
Yeah, I definitely don't think the U.S. can be global policeman. What I do know from having been U.N. ambassador and what I write about in the book is there are a set of challenges that we face as a planet, whether that's a warming planet, 70 million refugees and displaced persons now in our world, more than since Hitler, vast disparities in wealth and access to education, healthcare, et cetera, all the problems we know we face. And what I saw at the UN, I happened to be the U.S. ambassador, and the other 14 ambassadors are on their phones when everybody else is talking, and they're taking notes, and they're doodling, or they're planning their next meeting, or their lunch, or their cocktail hour, whatever the heck they're doing. Then they put their phones down when America's speaking, because they know that there was no solution to ISIS absent the U.S. summoning a 78-nation coalition together. There was no way that the Ebola epidemic in West Africa was going to get eradicated if the United States didn't play team captain.
You're saying the U.S. cannot relinquish that responsibility despite all the costs that come with it. I mean, not to mention just the expense. The U.S. has an indispensable role.
Well, it's very hard to talk about in the abstract. Again, there wouldn't be anybody, I think, on the progressive side, I think this is still true, that would disagree with the idea that President Obama did the right thing sending, yes, the U.S. military, but along with 2,000 public health professionals into West Africa to build facilities so that Ebola patients could be isolated, to support Guineans and Liberians and Sierra Leoneans. I tell that story in the book. I mean, it's the most moving thing to
see. And it's one of the great success stories.
It's one of the great success stories for which President Obama gets no credit whatsoever, because when you've prevented a crisis, that doesn't show up in the ledger. And so my point, though, is that I think there's a risk right now of, especially with how long we've been in Afghanistan and the debate about that and the disaster that was Iraq and all the very legitimate questions about Libya. But U.S. leadership is essential. I mean, that the alternative is a China-led world order, which is where we will be heading if we continue to retreat. Potentially, we're not there yet, but you'll get the Chinese-led anti-Ebola coalition, and that will involve massive human rights abuses of the people who are on the front lines, quarantining people without any regard either for their health, basically writing them off in the interest of the larger collective along the same lines as happens inside China's boundaries. So America has an overly militarized foreign policy. Our military, crazily, without any congressional debate, is now active in counterterrorism operations in 40% of the countries in the world. That is totally not sustainable. And yet, our diplomatic corps, which already was small and modest compared to our military, but has now been ravaged further by the current administration's attacks on civil servants and on diplomats and on expertise generally. And yet, we can't give up on American diplomacy. And American diplomacy has been catalytic. And if we think we can pull back, that is the rude awakening that we are beginning to live right now.
We could go on, obviously, but we should leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Samantha Power was Barack Obama's ambassador to the UN. She talked with Steve about her memoir, The Education of an Idealist. She's widely considered to top the shortlist for Secretary of State in a Democratic administration. I would really like to believe that no one wants to go to war. And yet, we seem incapable of pulling off lasting peace. So maybe the issue is not what's wrong with war, but what's right with it.
I wrote this book in response to a bumper sticker. I got tired of seeing that bumper sticker we all see, "War is not the answer." And I said, look, it depends on what the question is. War is often the answer to the most important questions of political life. Statehood, territoriality, power, what states exist and what states don't exist is nearly always decided by war. Every contemporary state is the product of war and violence, for better or worse. I am a proponent of being realistic, and the real world is not what we would like it to be. In the real world, war and violence are the normal state of affairs. And to try to deny that, to engage in wishful thinking, is dangerous.
Coming up, why we can't stop going to war. I'm Ann Strangchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. I could tell you that war is barbaric, irrational, destructive, wrong. But honestly, that would be simplistic. War has also been a path to peace, to freedom, to liberation. So I don't know, can war be a good thing? Political scientist Benjamin Ginsberg took a lot of flack for writing a book on the benefits of war.
When I called the book The Worth of War, it was designed to make people stop and become annoyed and see what it was that I had to say.
When you say the worth of war, it sounds as though you're saying there are cases in which it's worth people dying. And the thing is, that's how most wars start, right? People feel that there is some central issue so important, so overwhelming that it's worth a lot of people dying for. And then the whole thing turns into a slaughter. There's trench warfare, there are atomic bombs, or napalm, or mass rape, or hospitals are bombed. And it just seems wrong to say, yeah, but think of the benefits.
You know, the emphasis that I give in the opening chapter of the book, I borrow from Thucydides, the great Greek historian, the chronicler of the Peloponnesian Wars. Thucydides said, war is a stern teacher. And what does it teach? It teaches people to think clearly, to think rationally. That seems to fly in the face of our idea of war as irrational, horrible, you know,
driven by emotion.
Driven by emotion. But Thucydides said that those unable to think rationally, those unable to think logically, those who base their lives on delusion, they will not survive the audit of warfare.
I don't know, Ben. That suggests that we've had so many wars, then you'd think human beings would be getting smarter and smarter. You know, I mean, look at the Middle East. I don't think you can argue that we're getting smarter.
Well, to some extent, we are smarter and smarter.
How?
I'm not saying civilization might not have advanced with that war. But in point of fact, war has been a great force advancing civilization. As I mentioned, much of the technology we use was developed as a result of military needs. Everywhere you look around, microwaves, jet aircraft, nuclear technology, chemical technology, all of this was advanced as a result of military needs. Your peaceful city planner has as his ancestor or her ancestor a military planner.
So are you saying that the origin of the state, in some ways, the origin of the nation, is in war?
Well, of course it is. That's what states are for.
To make war?
To make war. That's what they do. I think that's the only thing they do well.
I thought they were there to provide for their citizens.
Well, they are. The first goal is to protect their citizens. You know, states are a kind of protection racket. You pay taxes in exchange for protection from foreign and domestic foes. The advent of states has been a great culling process in which those that can effectively wage war are still with us and those that can't wage war are no longer with us.
You've been making the case that war is inevitable. Maybe we just think it's inevitable because it always has been. That doesn't mean it will be in the future.
Well, that's correct. We don't know what the future holds. We do know that war has been a main driver of history, and we know that as we look around the world, there are groups and forces and individuals with hostile intent. There are people out there who hate us. It's not that they don't know us well. It's not that they have some illusions about us. They hate us. That's just a fact. There are people who want what we have. There are people who believe they would benefit if we disappeared from the face of the earth. So I think it's, in my mind, folly to think that war can be banished in this reality. Perhaps there's some other Star Trek reality where everyone is peaceful, but there's no reason to believe that we'll achieve that in the near term.
Benjamin Ginsberg teaches political science at Johns Hopkins. His book is called The Worth of War. And if you thought that was a provocative title, how about this one? War is Beautiful. That's the conclusion David Shields came to after studying hundreds of war photos, all of them published on the front page of the New York Times. Shields says the Times has made war beautiful, and he thinks that is a terrible problem. Charles Monroe Kane sat down with him to talk about war photography and beauty.
I want to use the word you used because I found that to be very powerful, and the word you used is beautiful. War is Beautiful is the title of your book. Talk about provocative.
Right.
And these photos, you know, I was like, okay, I get your argument, blah, blah, blah. I got your book. Oh, my God. They are beautiful. They're really
Thanks.
Beautiful. Yeah, they could be hanging in a museum. What's wrong with that? What are you getting at with that?
For 20 years, from the first Gulf War until through 2013, I would be struck by at least a couple times a week and sometimes several times a week. I'd be struck by pictures of war that sort of fed my war porn addiction. You know, it was really, these pictures were surpassingly beautiful. They were basically war as, what would you call them, kind of 20th century modernist masterpieces. Picture after picture, photo after photo seemed to me to be virtually appropriating Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Jasper Johns, Richard Diebenkorn. I mean, it was just stunning to me how much of the war had been abstracted away from any kind of raw, naked, visceral horror and sort of uploaded into a realm of very abstract horror. The opening line of the book is an epigraph from Edmund Burke, who says that horror is very beautiful when kept at a severe distance. And it seems to me that these pictures function to disseminate a certain kind of ideology subtextually, namely that we sort of tell ourselves as readers of the paper that we're informed and somehow semi-concerned citizens and that we have properly bleeding hearts. But in reality, these pictures keep the war at, you might say, psychic arm's length.
I was struck by two things. One, that they really weren't as graphic as I thought they were going to be. And two, that they're still very powerful. What do you want? Do you want more carnage? What do you want us to see?
You know, General Sherman said war is hell. And these pictures portray war as a sort of very pretty heck. First of all, I want us as citizen readers to bring enormously needed skepticism to the cultural work that these pictures do. And then I want us to depend far less on institutions that work hand in glove with the U.S. government. And third, you know, struggle more with its happy willingness to print pictures that just swoon in a kind of corporate folk art.
I hear what you're saying, but I can imagine someone saying, you know, man, they're only photographs. What's the harm?
On the one hand, you could say, what's the problem? So what? You know, the Times runs 365 pictures every year, and here's a picture. But I looked at literally 9,000 front pages of the New York Times through microfilm and microfiche from 1991 through 2013, and we found 1,000 color war photos. Color pics started in October 97. We found 1,000 color war photos, and of those 1,000, 700 fulfilled my criterion of pictures that, in my view, aestheticized horror. And I found precious few examples that, to me, in my view, conveyed the raw horror. So you could say, what's the harm? But I guess the book is trying to argue, what subcurrent is running underneath that picture? Is there an irreducible glamour? Where is the horror? Where is the cost?
Is that policy or is this happening kind of on accident?
I think that's the $64,000 question. I mean, this book is not an investigative book in the sense that I've uncovered 47 internal memos at the New York Times in which Dick Cheney and John Kerry have sent memos to the New York Times, and they said, if you ever print a picture of a dead soldier, that you will be denied access to the higher levels of government. You know, I don't have any such proverbial smoking gun. And I think it's an open question as to what's happening. Have all these photographers simply gone to school on the Western pictorial tradition and they can't help but take pictures of war as romance, as glamour, as beauty, as glory? Have the photo editors gone to school on the same tropes? To what degree does the New York Times instantiate its own authority by having access to the U.S. government? To what degree does that access depend on the Times, in my view, pseudo-covering the war? You know, Lyndon Johnson said during the Vietnam War, I can't win this war without the support of the New York Times. And then I follow up by saying, a New York Times picture is worth 1,000 mirrors.
There's a lot of images from those wars that we've seen, just still images. Have they seduced us?
To me, these pictures are effective seduction, because if these pictures appeared on the front page of the Wall Street Journal or USA Today or the New York Daily News, there's no story because people understand those papers to be rightward-leaning, military-leaning, Fox News-esque, Murdoch-esque papers whose agenda is quite clear. But the Times' brand is weirdly a kind of quasi-neutrality. And I think seduction is particularly problematic when we don't know the agenda of the seducer. And I even feel somewhat complicit. I wish I had gotten this book done 10 years earlier. But I felt seduced for too long. And this book is an attempt to break that seduction.
David Shields is the author of War is Beautiful, the New York Times pictorial guide to the glamour of armed conflict. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. And if you want to see some of those photos they were talking about, visit our website at ttbook.org. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. It's tempting to think that war is inevitable, that human beings are just too violent, too aggressive to maintain any kind of lasting peace. Does it really have to be that way?
Liberia had gone from bad to worse to ridiculous.
Liberian peace activist Lima Bowie.
People were inventing new ways of killing people. Pregnant women were being degutted. People were using plastic bags to drop in people's eyes and melting hot objects over people's bodies. So it was a terrible time. There was no regard for women or their place in society or their lives. It was just easy to humiliate, rape, and to oppress them. There is something about being pushed to the wall. You have two options, to either give in or fight back. The one thing that I can say was that we knew we would die. But the question was, do you want to die without even trying, or do you want to die? Then let the history be that you died trying. We didn't think that we would bring peace, but we knew that we would give the world another side of the conflict. So when we stepped out, it was about changing the narrative about war.
Back in 2003, the civil war in Liberia had been going on seemingly forever. There were unspeakable atrocities on both sides. And then Lima Bowie basically stood up and said, enough. She gathered the women of Liberia together in a nonviolent protest, and it ended the civil war. Not only did her efforts lead to the ouster and imprisonment of the dictator Charles Taylor, she also won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011. Steve Paulson wanted to know why, when things looked so hopeless, Lima thought she could make a difference.
There were so many things that you were up against, and one of them was that Charles Taylor had prohibited any public gatherings of protesters, but you and these other Christian and Muslim women in your movement gathered every day, and there were thousands of you demanding peace, demanding an audience with Taylor. Why didn't he arrest you, or why didn't he have you killed?
Well, that is the question that many people still ask till today, but I say one thing. What I've come to learn is that when you have brutal dictators and violent people, they have no response for nonviolence. So it totally took him off guard. It would have been easy for us to come out and throw rocks, and then he would have a reason for killing us. But how do you kill a group of people who sit there with a banner that says, we want peace now?
So incredibly dangerous, obviously. I mean, you said earlier that you assumed you would die during this protest. How scared were you?
There wasn't a lot of fear. In the initial stage when we started, yes, there were moments where I got afraid. But every day as we stepped out to protest, and every day as I got to know the women we were protesting with and know their stories, every day that confidence grew, the courage grew, and a lot of things. But there was very little fear by the time we entered the second week of protesting, let alone by the second year.
When did you think that you might actually have a chance to bring down Charles Taylor, to remove him from power?
When he agreed to meet us, because he had resisted and said no. When he agreed to meet us, something profound happened that day. We got to the executive mansion, and the soldiers said they had been instructed that if we were less than 25, we should not be allowed into his mansion. And then I asked, what if we're more than 25? And then they laughed, because at that time, there was so much fear around this figure, Taylor, that no one expected that more than 25 women would show up to protest him. And I said, what if we're more than 25? And they said, then you can come in. At that moment, we sent message up to where the women had lined up over 2,500 of us and say, calm down. And the soldiers saw that sea of white and they were like, wow, these women are really serious.
It's an astonishing story. And partly what you're saying is that he and pretty much everyone else in Liberia was just assuming that you would be terrified to go in and meet with him. Somehow you managed to turn that around. I mean, you seemed to get through that terror.
That day when we went to see Taylor, for me standing up to speak to him, I just told myself, because they had given me a statement to read. By the time I got up there, I said, I'm not going to read this statement because it's too sterile. It's just too neat for this man. I have to speak the truth about the situation of all of us women. We were refugees, we're internally displaced, we're victims of rape, we're living off of the streets. People and their children were dying on a daily basis. Our daughters and sons were being conscripted as small boys into his army, into the armies of the rebels. So I had to tell him this is the reality of the Liberian people. This is the reality specifically of women of this country. And there was no fear in that telling. All that was there was a huge sense of anger that this one man has put us in all of this mess. That was what I was thinking on that day.
Well, eventually, you brokered a peace deal. Amazingly, a peace deal between Charles Taylor and the rebel warlords. You forced Taylor out of power, and he was later arrested for war crimes. Your movement led to the election of the first woman president in Africa. Truly a remarkable story. And it's remarkable partly because it's so rare. Almost always, it's the generals, not the peace activists, who win. And I guess it raises the question of whether peace really can defeat war in any systematic way.
Well, I think where we need to come in this world, especially now, is to understand that good can always overcome evil and peace can definitely defeat war. You know, war, if you go back to the Liberian story, it was just a matter of time that peace was going to take over, peace was going to win.
Why would that be just a matter of time? It would seem that it could just drag on forever.
Well, it would seem that it would drag on forever, but I tell you one thing, that even those with the guns, they always pick up the guns, not in the name of war. And you need to remember that. When people go to war, they're always saying we're fighting in the name of peace, which is ironical, because there's no way fire can put out fire. So if you're going to war because you want peace, if someone offers you the perfect alternative to what you're killing yourselves for, you're bound to reach out and grab it.
But there are an awful lot of leaders, of historians, of philosophers who say war is inevitable, that we've always had war from the beginning of history. It seems to be a part of human nature. Are you saying war is not inevitable?
I can tell you one thing for free. Because of the way the world has come to glorify violence, that's why people think that war is inevitable. I think if we persistently and consistently throw out peace as the only alternative, because gun is the easiest way and a cowardly way of solving problems.
You mentioned that it's usually the men in power who conduct these wars. I'm assuming you would say that women have a particular role, a special role to play in preventing war.
Oh, definitely. The way I talk about it when I go to places of conflict is that in communities where you have a lot of the recruitment taking place, the women are the ones who know every young person. And so the metaphor I would want to use is her house. If it is dark, she can walk in and touch anything. And if you decide to fix her house and leave her out of it, you're leaving a very vital component of that fixing out of it. The woman knows of all of the fighters who you can talk to on which way and bring them back to a point of understanding. You keep them out of the room. You keep the conscience of those men out of the room. You keep the history of their lives out of the room. You keep the interaction in the community out of the room. And I think it's important for people to understand that, that process of bringing the country back to stability needs the involvement, intervention of every member of the population. If you're leaving 50% of the population out of the process, it's like trying to see a whole picture with one eye cover.
You see what you're advocating here as being realistic. I mean, this is not just pie-in-the-sky idealism. You think this works?
I think so. I believe it in my guts. And the reason why I'm saying it is, please help me understand. A few years ago, we're getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Today, we have ISIS. A few years ago, we got rid of Gaddafi. What we see in Libya is a total mess. A few years ago, Syria started with just protests, and then one armed group got in, another armed group got in. What we see now is another mess. Yemen and all of the bombings that have been taking place by the different high power countries. If violence could end anything, our world would be a peaceful place. What we've seen in this short period from 9/11 till today is a world that is even more dangerous. You want to go to concerts, you think twice. More than ever before in the history of the world, everyone lives with a deep sense of fear. If violence could solve any problem, why don't we have global peace?
That is a very good question. Wow, you are so inspiring. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Lima Bowie talking with Steve Paulson. She won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011 for her role in ending the brutal civil war in Liberia. She's the founder and president of the Bowie Peace Foundation Africa. I think Lima's words resonate more strongly than ever this week, when we've all been feeling frightened by how close and how quickly we came to the brink of war. I don't know about you, but it helps me to remember her message and that there are people like her in the world. That's it for our show today, but there is always more on our website at ttbook.org. You can sign up for our newsletter, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Angelo Bautista. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Anne Strange-Champs. Thanks for listening.